Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, even millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. So how exactly are these gurus changing our lives and the world around us? And who holds them to account? Find out by subscribing to The New Gurus wherever you get your podcasts.
You are bound to devote yourself to the long conflict between the light and the dark.
The dark is rising. An immersive audio adventure, adapting Susan Cooper's classic fantasy novel into a gripping 12-part family drama.
Everything had changed.
The dark is rising. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 6th of January, these are our main stories. Violence has spread across Sinaloa State following the arrest of a powerful Mexican narco trafficker. President Putin's announcement of an Orthodox Christmas ceasefire in Ukraine has been dismissed as a stunt. Voting for Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives has gone into a third day, paralysing the work of government. Also in this podcast...
A lot of people don't have birth certificates. A 25-year-old man can walk in and claim himself to be 15. So that is what he will present when he's making his international passport.
We find out why that means Cameroon's youth football team is in real trouble. Don't go outside. That is the message the authorities have for people in parts of the northern Mexican state of Sinaloa as violence there spreads. It follows the arrest of a powerful Mexican narco trafficker, Ovidio Guzman, in the state capital, Culiacan. Gunmen loyal to him and his father, El Chapo Guzman, who is in a US prison, have swarmed into the city, blocking roads and burning vehicles. This attack on an army checkpoint was filmed by a family peering out from behind a curtain. Well, the situation is so volatile, the US has felt obliged to comment. Ned Price is a spokesperson for the US State Department.
We, of course, have been closely following the violence in parts of Mexico, namely in Sinaloa, over the past few days. There has been reports of gunfire, roadblocks and fires. We have advised U.S. citizens in Sinaloa to remain alert for potential violence throughout the state. We advise Americans not to travel to Sinaloa as a result.
I spoke to our Latin America regional editor, Leonardo Rocha. So are the authorities in the state of Sinaloa able to bring the situation under control in Culiacán?
They're trying to play it down and say they will do their best to regain control of the situation. What's happening now is looting, widespread looting, and that's because of the lawlessness. The airport is still closed. It will remain closed, not only in Culiacán, but in two other cities. More than 100 flights were cancelled. It's very worrying because when the night comes, what will the cartels do? And that's the main concern for people there who are remaining at home, staying at home for the whole day.
I suppose at least this time the authorities appear to have got their target, Ovidio Guzman, out of the state and to Mexico City. So there's no focus for these gunmen as there was 3 years ago, wasn't there? They actually got him back, or they forced the government to release him.
That was key because the last time, as you mentioned there, 3 years ago, they were forced to release because their gangs threatened to retaliate and kill hundreds of people. And there was a lot of expectation. So is he really arrested? Is he out of the state? And the government said that he is now in a safe place in Mexico City. They will try to extradite him to the United States. And that's what every drug dealer, every drug lord in Mexico wants to avoid. Because once they go to the U.S., like El Chapo Guzman, they lose all the privileges they have in prison. And also the chances of escaping from prison are minimal. Mm. And we have a very worrying situation. He just showed how much power these gangs still have. I mean, Ovidio Guzman is one of the leaders of this Sinaloa cartel. There are other leaders. His arrest has led to all this violence. It's very difficult for the government to do something about it, but they'll keep trying. Okay. And what is worrying now is for civilians there. They are very worried about what will happen tonight. Gunfire is still everywhere and the airport remains closed.
Leonardo Rocha. The U.S. House of Representatives on Thursday has spent a third day trying to elect a speaker. The process should have been a formality for the Republican leader Kevin McCarthy after his party won a majority in November's midterms. But a right-wing faction believe he is not conservative enough. The Democratic representative for Massachusetts, Catherine Clark, said Republicans were in chaos.
This intra-party fight that the American people have been drawn into is imperiling our national security. It will imperil the ability of this government to deliver basic services. It is imperiling our jobs and our responsibility to serve our constituents.
Our North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue reports from Washington.
Kevin McCarthy has made concessions to the rebels on issues such as committee assignments, removing a sitting speaker, and which legislation gets considered. But he is still unable to get enough votes within his own party, and nor can anyone else. And while there's no speaker, the House can't do a thing. Chamber utterly paralysed and locked into a seemingly endless loop. Groundhog Day, as one wag put it. The way out of the situation would be for some kind of compromise candidate to emerge. But until that happens, no one has any idea how long this could go on for.
Gary O'Donoghue. Will there be an Orthodox Christmas truce in Ukraine? Well, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has proposed one from noon on Friday to midnight on Saturday. Mr. Putin had reacted to an appeal, he says, by the Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill. But Ukraine has dismissed President Putin's proposal as just propaganda. Ukraine has said there could be no truce until all Russian forces had withdrawn from any occupied Ukrainian territory. I asked our reporter Will Vernon in Moscow why Mr. Putin had made this proposal now.
I think this statement was interesting for two reasons, really. I mean, one is that the Kremlin appeared to stress that, you know, President Putin ordered his troops to stop fighting, not because he's de-escalating, but because he had listened to the appeal from the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. Patriarch Kirill, early in the day, who's called for a Christmas truce to allow believers to attend church services for Orthodox Christmas, by saying in this statement that President Putin was merely fulfilling an appeal by the Orthodox Church, it perhaps portrays the president not as weak and more as a humanitarian. But I think the other interesting thing is that, you know, this comes just a few days after a large number of Russian troops, we don't really know how many, 89, say the defense ministry, which is still a lot, were killed in this Ukrainian strike on a temporary barracks in an occupied Ukrainian city in the east. So relatives of the dead, when that happened, politicians, commentators, very angry, a lot of anger over what happened there, people blaming incompetent military officials, you know, and this happened on New Year's Eve, the most important holiday in the Russian calendar. So I'm sure the last thing that the Kremlin wants now, you know, is a repeat of another disaster on another important Russian holiday.
What's been the reaction, sort of the less formal reactions from people in Russia?
I think this ceasefire fits in nicely with a kind of common narrative we have here, right, that's aimed primarily at the domestic audience, and that is that the Russians are the good guys. And I think this truce, you know, is a kind of tool that can be used by the Kremlin to demonize Ukraine. So the Ukrainians have dismissed this proposal, as you said. You know, a spokesman said that the Russian Federation must leave the occupied territories. Only then will it have a temporary truce. And now Moscow can claim that Ukraine does not respect religion, religious believers, and has no desire for peace. But I was reading through Telegram, the messenger app that's hugely popular here, some thoughts from the pro-Kremlin military bloggers. A lot of shock, a lot of surprise, a lot of criticism, actually, for this move by the Kremlin. One blogger writing, "What is this ceasefire for? The Ukrainians have already said they don't give a damn about Christmas. They'll continue shelling. Are we just going to sit there and not return fire?" Another one saying, "This ceasefire will be a disaster." And another one saying, "Putin should celebrate Christmas in the trenches with the troops, who will be spending 2 days observing a unilateral ceasefire."
Will Vernon in Moscow. Germany and Sweden have become the latest European countries to require negative COVID tests from travellers coming from China. Our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker has more details.
Germany has joined other EU countries such as Italy, France and Spain in requiring tests on passengers arriving from China. Sweden too has announced it will demand travellers show a negative test. It's in line with the latest EU guidance, which called for stricter controls. Beijing insists it's been transparent about sharing information on the virus with the World Health Organization after the UN agency said China was underrepresenting the true impact of the disease in terms of hospital admissions and deaths.
Jessica Parker. So, official COVID statistics in China don't appear to hold much weight with foreign governments at the moment. In China itself, people are becoming worried, not least because recent celebrity deaths suggest the number of people dying is higher than officially admitted, far higher. Our China media analyst, Carrie Allen, told me more about it.
There hasn't been much since China stopped recording the official COVID cases and deaths in the country. So that line hasn't been getting a lot of media attention in China. And it's now the case that a COVID death is only somebody who's passed away due to pneumonia or respiratory failure. But one of the big talking points over the last week or so has been that a number of people in the entertainment industry, including a 40-year-old opera singer, have died. And there's not been much details on her death, for example, nor the others. So it's been a big talking point among some people about whether it's COVID-related.
And what's the official line coming out of Beijing about its transparency?
Well, there's been an interview with State TV in which the director of Beijing's Institute of Respiratory Diseases admitted that the number of deaths of elderly people this winter has been definitely more than in past years. So that's the line that's come out from state media, that there have been more deaths of elderly people. But as to whether or not this is related to COVID, this has not been emphasised by Chinese media whatsoever. But one of the things that has been telling is that in the last few weeks, multiple cities and major districts in China have been reporting that their medical institutes have been under strain. Hospitals have been under strain. You call the emergency services and the phone number is engaged. This is something that has been a reality this year, and it hasn't been as much a reality in recent years.
And Kerry, obviously, the thing that people are really worried about is when this spreads beyond the cities, reaches the rural areas, it might be exacerbated by the travel brought about by Chinese New Year. To what extent is there evidence that the authorities there are aware of those big concerns and they're ramping up preparations for it?
Well, there's huge nervousness about this. In fact, some local governments are already trying to discourage people from travelling during Chinese New Year. And it's only 2 days away now until the travel period for buying tickets begins. And it's a period of time normally in China when hundreds of millions of people all travel at the same time. And there have been warnings going back to last month that small hospitals in rural areas cannot handle this. So what the government has been trying to do is it's been trying to tell fever clinics that they need to upgrade before the end of last year. They've been saying that this was a priority so that they can handle this. But at the same time, looking at major cities like Beijing and Shanghai and seeing that they're struggling to deal with the virus now, and there's another wave on the way, that there are huge concerns on Chinese social media.
That was Kerry Allen. Now, the revelations keep coming as the tensions at the heart of the British royal family have been laid bare in almost unprecedented detail by Prince Harry's new book, Spare. In an earlier podcast, we heard that the prince accused his brother William, the Prince of Wales, of physically attacking him. It's alleged to have taken place in 2019, after the brothers had spoken about Harry's wife, Meghan. Harry also says that Prince William and his wife, the Princess of Wales, gave their approval to him wearing a Nazi uniform at a party. Buckingham Palace has refused to comment. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
What was supposed to be a carefully choreographed global publishing event next Tuesday has descended into a free-for-all as copies of Prince Harry's memoirs have leaked or been put on sale. The most startling allegation so far, published by The Guardian, is that Prince William, now the heir to the throne, assaulted his brother Harry in 2019. Harry says that Prince William came to his home in Kensington Palace. He says William described Meghan as rude, difficult and abrasive. The two men, he says, were soon shouting at each other. Prince William, it's alleged, then lost his temper, grabbed Prince Harry and then knocked him to the ground. This excerpt has been voiced by a BBC producer.
He grabbed me by the collar, ripping my necklace. I landed on the dog's bowl, which cracked onto my back, the pieces cutting into me. I lay there for a moment, dazed, then got to my feet and told him to get out.
Habíamos acordado vernos unas horas después del funeral.
Meanwhile, in Spain, excerpts of the audiobook and copies of the whole memoir in print have been released. In the book, The Sun reports Harry writing that he and William begged their father not to marry Camilla, now the Queen Consort. Harry is also reported to have revealed that he lost his virginity to an older woman in a field behind a pub. Elsewhere, the prince is reported to have admitted taking cocaine as a teenager. In New York, one website reports Harry alleging that his attendance at a fancy dress party in Nazi uniform, something that he apologised for when it hit the front pages, was William and Kate's idea.
An arch nemesis. Strong words. What did you mean by that?
There has always been this competition between us, weirdly. I think it really plays into, always played by, the heir spare.
Prince Harry has conducted a round of broadcast interviews to publicise his book. There are more revelations and allegations to come. The palace has refused to comment on any of it.
Our royal correspondent Johnny Diamond there. Well, in his book, Prince Harry also says that he killed 25 people who he called enemy combatants while serving as a helicopter pilot in Afghanistan a decade ago. Paul Henley heard more from Johnny Diamond again.
It has been reported, and I haven't seen the book itself yet, but it's been reported by those who've read it, that Harry says in the book that he killed 25 people whilst he served in Afghanistan. He did two tours of duty with the military in Afghanistan. He uses the phrase, I think, taking them like pieces of chess off the chessboard. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to say, I think, for any serving or former member of the military to speak like that.
Is it? Is that unusual in itself?
Yeah, I mean, I've not heard members of the military. I mean, in private, they will talk about what they did during a tour of duty. But to speak like that about killing the enemy in individual numbers like that is pretty extraordinary. For a member of the royal family, even one who's not serving as a working member of the royal family, it is also extraordinary. Not that many of them have seen military action. The last one too would have been Prince Andrew, the Queen's second son, who fought in the war over the Falkland Islands, the Malvinas, as the Argentinians call it, back in the early 1980s. But even he didn't talk in any great detail about what he did. No, it's a sort of sharp intake of breath to hear Harry speak like that or to see the report of his writing.
That was Johnny Diamond. Still to come.
The people of Bewley, west of Inverness, knew that the tree which stood at the entrance to the village's priory had recently died as a result of Dutch elm disease.
Villagers in the Scottish Highlands mourn the loss of an elm tree believed to be almost 800 years old. Interpol says a notorious people smuggler known for his cruel and violent treatment of migrants has been arrested in Sudan. The International Policing Agency said the Eritrean national headed a major crime organisation behind the kidnapping, extortion and murder of East African migrants. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
This sounds like a rare breakthrough in the struggle to stop the cruel and unscrupulous traffickers who have caused the deaths of so many migrants. Kidane Zecharias Habtemariam from Eritrea was wanted by police in Ethiopia and the Netherlands. Interpol said he was the kingpin of a criminal gang behind the trafficking of thousands of victims. He was arrested after police in the United Arab Emirates focused on money laundering activities and found him in Sudan. The International Policing Agency said this was a significant blow to a major smuggling route towards Europe.
Will Ross, Sony has released the first accessible controller for its console, PlayStation 5, making it easier for players from the disabled community. It's being called Project Leonardo. Carney Sharp spoke to Steve Saylor, a YouTuber who's worked with Microsoft on Xbox accessibility and other gaming companies.
Xbox actually has had their adaptive controller for a couple years now, and one of the things that PlayStation players have been requesting is, when is PlayStation going to have an accessible controller? Because there's a lot of people, including my friends, who have never been able to play the award-winning PlayStation games that are really great for accessibility, such as games like The Last of Us Part 2, Marvel Spider-Man, and recently God of War Ragnarok. So now this controller can allow them to be able to play those games a lot easier and a lot more comfortable for them.
It's important that game companies are doing this. Sony says, we want to continue raising the bar to enable every gamer to experience the joy of play. As someone who is blind yourself, you know, when you hear Sony say that, how does that make you feel or your community feel?
It definitely makes us feel that at least that they are continuing to develop and add more accessibility. They really hit a lot of huge milestones when The Last of Us Part 2 came out back in 2020. It was sort of the first game that we saw that had an amazing amount of accessibility built in and the amazing amount of accessibility options that were available in the game. And every single PlayStation Studio-led game has had and improved on more accessibility as the years have come by. So seeing them be committed and creating this accessible controller just means that we know that they're putting basically their money where their mouth is, and including disabled players as part of the PlayStation family.
So tell us about your role as as someone who advises to make them more accessible. How much do these companies listen to you and take what you're saying to them on board? And do you see, for example, an idea being implemented not shortly after you've consulted with them?
It really depends on the studio. Generally, when I go in to consult with studios on how to be able to make their games more accessible, I'm usually one of several consultants that they would have come in, because each disability is different and each sort of lived-in experience is different depending on which disability you have. So there are times I definitely do see, sometimes whenever games come out, that there are things in there that I had suggested come to fruition, which is really great to be able to see. But honestly, the credit goes to the teams that work on these games, because they put in the amount of effort and years into making these games as accessible as possible. So they're the ones creating this. They're just allowing us to be able to take a look at it and making sure that they are working in this in the great way that works best for each disability. So it's an honor to be a part of the industry and being able to get to do that, because, I mean, who else didn't grow up basically saying, like, hey, I get to work and play with video games all day. So that's really cool.
That was Steve Saylor. Let's stay with tech matters now, because in Las Vegas, the huge Consumer Electronics Show opened on Thursday. For the next 2 days, more than 3,000 companies are going to be showing off their latest gadgets. And after 2 years of COVID disruption, the event is once again being held fully in person. The BBC's Zoe Kleiman is there, and I asked her what's impressed her so far.
I am in a giant conference hall, basically, and it's absolutely rammed with stalls from all around the world. Some are big names that you'd recognize, like Amazon's Ring doorbell is here. It's actually built a little house in the middle of the room for people to check out their home security products. And there are lots of tiny firms as well from places like Shenzhen in China, from India, from Korea, who've come to showcase the tech and the innovative ideas that they've come up with. What they're hoping to get here is investment. So this is not an event that's open to the public. It's open to, you know, journalists and analysts like me who come along to look at tech trends and see what the next big thing looks like it might be. But also investors come along here and they are looking for new products that they think will make the cut and that will be in all of our homes in maybe 1, 2, 5 years' time. You've got all sorts of innovation. There are drones, there are health and well-being devices, there are digital tattoos, which, by the way, I did partake in. Thankfully, it's washed off now, but I was starting to wonder whether I'd be stuck with it forever. There's just a lot of innovation, and it's quite a breath of fresh air after a really difficult time for the tech sector.
It's been a terrible time for the tech sector, particularly on the markets for big tech. But the sense that you're getting is that there's, for the right idea, there is money. There are investors out there. Is that right?
It's a really wobbly time for big tech. And big tech has been struck by an unfortunate combination, if you like, of the cost of living biting and consumers spending less money and a fall in advertising revenue, which a lot of the big companies rely on, especially social media companies, because everyone's feeling the pinch. And so businesses are taking out less advertising, basically. I think, I have to say, I've been coming to this for a few years now, and I think it's a little bit less frivolous than perhaps it's been in previous years. You know, you used to have robots rolling around on the floor, things making cocktails, drones buzzing around your head. It feels not quite like that sort of big circus anymore, and I think that's probably a sign of the times. But that said, there is still plenty of colourful stuff here designed to catch your eye. Most of it will never see the light of day, you know, let's be honest. But there is some gold here, and some of it we will almost certainly be using in the future.
So fewer cocktails, more proper content.
Yeah, sounds a bit disappointing when you put it like that, doesn't it?
That was Zoe Kleiman in Las Vegas. Cameroon is really struggling to put out an under-17 football side for its upcoming international fixtures. And that is because a lot of them are too old, some of them way too old. The squad members underwent MRI scans to see the telltale signs of those who were over 17, and the majority of them failed the test. The BBC's sports reporter Oluwaseuna Okeleji told me more.
Most of Cameroon's success in youth tournaments have been clouded by allegations of the use of overage players. So when former Barcelona and Inter Milan striker Samuel Eto'o was elected as president of the governing body FECAFOOT in 2021, he promised to take action to combat the long-running problem. So as his country prepared to host this five-nation regional tournament this month, Eto'o ordered 8 testing for the squad. So of the initial 30-member group, 21 failed the test. And Cameroon suffered a fresh setback as 11 new players also failed the test on Tuesday. So now coach Jean-Pierre Fiala is now struggling to find replacement.
Wow, so this fraud has been going on at a staggering level. Why is it done, for a start? Do people not rely on people having legitimate certificates to prove their age?
Unfortunately, in Africa, there's something called age declaration, because a lot of people don't have birth certificates, poor record keeping from government authorities. A 25-year-old man can walk into a council office and declare himself to be 15. So that is what he will present when he's making his international passport.
To what extent is this a problem across Africa?
A huge problem. Nigeria, for instance, they are the most successful country at under-17 world level. They've won the tournament 5 times, but every time they play at the World Cup, you hear accusations from opposing teams saying these players look bigger, these players look older, and blah, blah, blah. Eventually, FIFA in 2009 were forced to introduce the MRI scan to determine age test for players who will be eligible to play in their tournament.
To be fair to Nigeria, since 2009, when these bone tests at a measure how the bones had stopped growing were brought in, Nigeria has actually won it twice since then. But do you think what Samuel Eto'o is doing now will really knock it on the head?
Well, it will, because according to a journalist with the national broadcaster, he says a lot of people have applauded the decision of Samuel Eto'o to go public with this, because the Cameroon football system must do away with age cheats and adults parading themselves as teenagers. But that decision taken by Eto'o also have his own criticism with a section of the local media saying that even though the statements by FECAFOOT did not include names of affected players, some felt the information shared publicly about field tests is very sensitive because it involved minors who could have been affected.
That was Oluwaseuna Okeleji. A tree in Bewley in the Scottish Highlands, believed to be Europe's oldest witch elm, has fallen down after getting Dutch elm disease. The so-called Bewley elm, which was believed to be almost 800 years old, is mentioned in documents connected with the founding of a priory in the village way back in 1230. Our Scotland correspondent James Shaw takes up the story.
The people of Bewley, west of Inverness, knew that the tree which stood at the entrance to the village's priory had recently died as a result of Dutch elm disease, but they had not expected it to fall so soon. A cracking sound was heard and the tree came down, knocking over several gravestones and coming to rest on a wall of the priory. Rosemary MacDonald from the local community council said it was a sad moment for the village.
We did try to save it, but they came and took a limb off it about a few weeks ago, and I think maybe that was the start of the decline. And this morning it just collapsed. No wind, no rain, just decided it had enough.
Last October, Bewley held an event to celebrate the ancient tree's place at the heart of the village. The stories, memories and archive material they shared will be published later this month. The Bewley elm stood through centuries of Scottish history, from the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314 to the union with England in 1707 and the independence referendum less than 9 years ago. The tree will not stand as a witness to the next 800 years. It will continue to exist online as a 3D model which captures every gnarled branch and knot of its centuries of growth. And a new witch elm will be planted in the spring.
That report by James Shaw in Scotland. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, even millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. So how exactly are these gurus changing our lives and the world around us? And who holds them to account? Find out by subscribing to The New Gurus wherever you get your podcasts.